Support for this podcast comes from CDTA, The Eagle, a Times Union podcast driven by CDTA. Hey, it's Jessica Marshall here with another episode of The Eagle, a Times Union podcast. If you get to do one thing for fun in the next week or so, definitely take some time to check out the tulip scene across the Capital Region right now. The annual colorful blooms are starting to pop. Late April this year also brings us a New York State budget. It's a $237 billion behemoth, as our Capital correspondent Dan Clark described it.
Finally! We have a housing deal for New York City and the state of New York. We got it done.
Governor Kathy Hochul touted plans in the new budget to spur housing development. Also a big ticket item getting lots of buzz, and the pun is intended here, new tools to crack down on illegal cannabis. There's a lot more in the budget that's newsworthy. So Dan Clark joins us now to go over some of the things that we should all know about this year's budget. Dan, you were following this annual process that the state goes through every year. You know, they're supposed to have it done on April 1st, but they never do, right?
Rarely they do, but usually not.
But end of April is not too late? Is that unusually late?
It is unusually late if you look at the past decade. Usually under Governor Andrew Cuomo, they would try to pass the budget within a few days of April 1st. Under Hochul, it's looked a little different. This year, obviously, we're about 3 weeks late. Last year, we were a month late.
And it's an improvement then.
Right. A little bit of an improvement. And then the year before that, it was a few weeks late as well. So at the end of the day, the consequences of that are not major if they pass budget extenders, which they did do. You know, everybody's funded. And as Hochul and legislative leaders like to say, they want a good budget, not a on-time budget necessarily.
Okay. Now, they think that they have a pretty good, solid budget, $237 billion. Give us the highlights. What are kind of the top-level items that have been getting the most attention?
Sure. So the issues that we were watching during the whole budget process were in three groups, really, the most controversial. The first being housing, the second being Medicaid, and the third being school funding. So those all shook out in very different ways. The governor has made a real big push to advance housing across the state, and the legislative leaders also agree with that. The legislature also agrees with that. However, this housing deal really focuses more on New York City than outside of the state. So we have a developer tax incentive. We have other rules that will help spur housing growth. We also have new tenant protections too. So for people upstate, if their locality opts into that, they can have that. But other than that, there's a tax credit for multifamily dwellings as well in the housing plan for upstate, but not too much there.
Okay, so housing, that was a big thing. You know, she made a big deal of that once everything was passed. What else? Something about cannabis maybe? Was that another
one? Oh, man. I mean, cannabis was also a big issue. And I think that's probably the issue that most people who look at the budget will relate to. So it's been a huge problem, I mean, everywhere, but especially in New York City, these illegal cannabis shops opening that are claiming to be legal and have products that have not been tested, have products that may not be safe. You just don't know unless it goes through the state's verification process. So what they did in this budget was, instead of having just the state be able to close those shops, now local governments will be able to pass a law that designates how they can do it themselves, whether that's their Department of Health or some other agency in their municipality. There is a asterisk there in New York City, where New York City can start doing this immediately.
Okay. I was going to say, where has this been the most, you know, problematic in the state?
I mean, definitely New York City. If you go down there, and I mean, even in the days immediately after legalization, where dispensaries weren't a thing, like none were open, none were approved, you saw those cannabis shops start to pop up down there already. So it wasn't a huge surprise to many that it became a problem, but they're hoping this helps them crack down on it.
We shall see. All right, what are some of the other top level stuff, like the really high level stuff?
So the other big buckets are Medicaid and school funding. So I'm going to start with schools because that is also very relatable to a lot of people. Governor Hochul in January proposed changing the overall formula for how the state sends funding to school districts. Her excuse was, districts have lost enrollment in the past decade, but they're still getting the same amount of money based on that higher enrollment. So she wanted to change the formula so that those schools that have lost enrollment would get less money. But unfortunately for her, nobody in the legislature liked that on either side of the aisle.
Yeah.
Because the change would have meant cuts for half of the school's districts this year. So instead of doing that, they're going to take a year to look at that formula and then come up with something permanent next year. So that's school funding. Medicaid is a little bit of a wonky issue. The long and short of it is the biggest piece of it probably is the home care piece, where there's a program called CDPAP. For somebody that's in it, they know it. For people who are not in it, they don't know it. Basically, it allows somebody who needs home care to select that person who's going to offer that care. So instead of going through an agency where you have a random person come to your home, you could select your parent. You could select your child to be your caregiver, and you can get paid for that work. So as part of that, there are hundreds of these companies around the state called fiscal intermediaries. They handle all the finances of the money coming from Medicaid to paying the workers, that kind of thing. They're kind of the middleman in that process. So what the state budget does is cut out all of those middlemen, all of those, you know, financial intermediaries, and they're going to have just one of those with some subcontractor opportunities, but the one apparently will be picked through a bidding process, and we'll see who it is. During the budget, what I had been told by lawmakers behind the scenes was this company called Public Partnership would be doing it, but that's not certain just yet.
Okay. Well, more to come on that then. So you also kind of picked out some of the smaller items that maybe got a little lost. Maybe people, you know, who are just reading about this in the news might not get this information. What are some of the kind of buried items that you thought were important?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, one is mental health, and this is really important. So under the state's current, well, not current because the budget has passed, but under the state's previous laws, what would happen was if you are, you have private insurance and you have to seek out-of-network care for mental health or addiction treatment, what would happen was your private insurer could negotiate the rate that they pay that provider out-of-network, and then you're on the hook for the rest of it. So what the budget changes in that regard is if you are going to an out-of-network provider, your insurance company has to pay for it at least the same amount as Medicaid. There were no rules on that before. So that's one that will help a lot of people in a lot of different ways. And then there are other really small things. For example, mixed martial arts was legalized in New York just a couple of years ago. And now the gate tax there will be cut basically in half. So, and they lobbied for that pretty strongly this year because they want more people to buy tickets. Mm-hmm. And with that tax on it, they thought it wasn't a good enough, you know, incentive to go to these MMA events. And there are all these, you know, tiny little things in there that affect a lot of people, but may not necessarily be reported. You may not know that it affects you until you're put in that specific situation.
So, all right, is everybody happy with this budget?
No. I mean, here's the thing. A lot of people are happy, but a lot of those people that are happy are in the state legislature because, for one, they wanted this deal to get done. It was 3 weeks late. But for two, this is really the best deal that they could get out of the governor, who really held on to a lot of things at the end, including a provision called mayoral control. It only affects New York City. It basically gives the mayor control over city schools. That was going to expire this year, and they ended up extending it 2 years because the governor put it into budget talks at the very last minute. So, you know, a lot of people weren't happy about that. But people also say all of these different items in it. For example, the housing package. Housing advocates say it doesn't go far enough to protect tenants. Developers say it doesn't go far enough for them to actually build a lot of housing. On the Medicaid side, fiscal watchdogs will say, wow, this is great for you to cut so much spending. But people who need home care have said, I really hate that my, you know, fiscal intermediary is going to go away. I really like them. So it's a mixed bag in the sense that I think a lot of advocacy groups didn't really get what they wanted. But in the other sense of that, compromise is always going to happen in the state budget.
Sure, sure. Now, one of the issues that had come up in recent years that was huge and divisive was bail reform. Did they touch that at all this year?
No, not this year. And it didn't really come up as a big issue between Democrats and the governor. Republicans tried to make it an issue this year, but I think they're kind of running out of steam on that. And I think that they realize that. So they didn't push too hard against it this year. Democrats really didn't do much to kind of look at bail reform as being an indicator of crime. Instead, they put more money into law enforcement in New York City and other agencies of the state, and also to help prosecutors, you know, handle these cases, because those new rules mean more cases are being dismissed because they're more restricted.
All right. Well, I know that that was a particularly hot issue.
Yeah, continues to be.
Yeah. And I'm sure it'll come up again, right?
You know? Yes.
All right. So legislature's gone home. They've done their jobs for the summer, more or less. So it's kind of the low season. What is your kind of sense of what's going to happen in the next several months? You know, maybe when the issues that they're going to come up when they come back in the fall? Like, what's your kind of future prediction?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the short answer is we don't really know, because the main reason is it's an election year.
Ah, there we go. That touches upon the major issue here.
Right. So once they're done with session, I mean, after that, they're going to be campaigning all year. And unless it's an issue that's going to resonate with voters, they're going to want to keep it under wraps until they're either reelected or back in session next year. Because for one, I mean, if you come up with this big policy proposal in July and then you lose your race in November, I mean, that goes nowhere.
Right.
So,
sorry. You know,
exactly. So they're not really revealing too much of an agenda right now as to what they want to do. And I suspect that because of all of these groups being upset about the various deals in the budget, that they'll probably return to these same issues next year in some way, shape, or regard, including the school funding question.
All right. Well, lots to look forward to this coming year for many reasons. So thank you for that high-level look at the budget, and we will talk to you again when the session starts in the fall.
Sounds great.
Or sooner, whatever, you know, if something happens. To read more about the new state budget and other state house news, head over to our New York State section on timesunion.com. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe to Dan's Capital Confidential newsletter. You'll get news on state government and politics delivered right to your inbox every day. We're going to take a short break now, but when we come back, playwright Matthew Spangler will join us for a conversation about his stage adaptation of The Kite Runner, coming to Proctor's next week.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union subscriber today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Eagle, a Times Union podcast. I'm Jessica Marshall. The stage adaptation of Khaled Hosseini's best-selling novel, The Kite Runner, is coming to the Proctor's main stage on May 1st and 2nd. The play, like the book, follows the story of Amir, an Afghan refugee living in the United States who's determined to seek forgiveness for betraying his best friend during their childhood in an Afghanistan on the brink of the Taliban takeover. Playwright Matthew Spangler wrote the play in 2006 with Hosseini's blessing and guidance. And since then, the show has been performed on Broadway and on London's West End, as well as in several national tours throughout the United States and abroad. Spangler is a professor of performance studies at San Jose State University, where he teaches courses on how refugees and asylum seekers are represented through the performing arts. He joins me now on The Eagle. So The Kite Runner is not a new production, but I wonder why you think it has had such longevity. I mean, it's been on Broadway, it's been on the West End. Like, what about it kind of made it go so far?
I mean, I don't know. I suppose it's two things. One kind of happy and the other not. The happy one is that the book is really good. I mean, Khaled Hosseini has written a book that is just super good and people like reading it, and it takes you on this emotional journey. And it's got these really interesting and compelling characters. And just as literature, it's a great book. And the play is fairly true to the book, you know. So the play tries to represent the book in ways that are accurate to it. But I suppose the other reason, which is not as happy, is that Afghanistan has remained in the news in a variety of different ways over the last 20 years. And I say that's sort of a sad thing, perhaps, because the reasons it's remained in the news have not been largely good for Afghans.
Now, take me back to when you first kind of encountered the book, I guess, and what spurred you to adapt it for the stage.
I am a professor and I teach courses in how refugees and asylum seekers are represented through the arts. And I've been doing that for many years, ever since I was in graduate school. And separately, I'm also a playwright. And I write most of my plays based on books. I like working with novelists and trying to figure out ways of turning their books into theater pieces. And occasionally those two things intersect for me, which they do in Kite Runner, but several of my other plays too, The Beekeeper of Aleppo, Tortilla Curtain. Many of my other plays are also about immigrant experiences. My new play, Cowboys and East Indians. That's why I read the book in 2000. It was published in 2003. I read it in 2004, I think. So about a year after it was published. And I thought, all right, well, there are some scenes here that could make an interesting play. And I reached out to Khaled. He lives in San Jose, which is not far from me. I'm about 20 minutes away.
That's and convenient.
It was convenient. So we met up in a coffee place and I shared my ideas for him. This was 2005, I guess. And so we've sort of been working together on it since 2005. And then I wrote that first draft of the script in maybe 2006. And I've been revising the script ever since, right? Like the script is very different today, perhaps, than what it was in 2006. But that's just because, you know, you make changes along the way.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, I mean, how has it changed, you know, the actual production? You know, what are some of the, you know, high level ways that it's changed over the years?
To be honest with you, each production of this play has a different script. And even now there's a parallel tour, as you may know, in the UK. Same set, same costumes, same director, different actors, obviously, and a somewhat different script. Because, you know, I like the collaborative process in the rehearsal room. And to be really honest with you, although I teach about refugees in a university classroom, like I have not lived that experience. And we have actors and other people, designers working on the show who identify more closely with the region that this play and book come from, either as a geographical matter or maybe emotionally, because maybe their family immigrated from Lebanon or Syria or wherever. And so they live it in ways that I don't. And so in the rehearsal room, we change the script to accommodate a lot of ideas that the actors have. Maybe somebody's like, hey, there's this really beautiful line from the book and it's something my grandmother used to say. And could we include it in the script? You know, that kind of thing. And so we'll put things in, or maybe there's a character that's not quite coming off in a way that's comfortable for the actor to play it. And maybe if just this line could be a little bit different, it would allow me as an actor to do something different with that scene. Those are the ways the play has changed. And so every version of the play is somewhat different from every other version of the play.
That's fascinating. Now, I actually want to talk a little bit more. You already touched on it, but kind of the fact that the plays, not just this one, but some of the other plays that you write as well, are all about kind of cultures and experiences that aren't your own, and how you have had to kind of learn and adapt and bring elements, like authentic elements in. I mean, tell me about that process.
You know, you have to listen. You have to spend a long time listening to, if you're adapting a novel, you talk with the author, and part of that is developing a relationship with them. So they trust you and you trust them. And then once you get into a rehearsal space, if you're working with material that, yeah, is not your own as a life experience, especially when you've got actors who identify with that life experience, I think the playwright needs to be really deferential, really humble. It's about listening. It's about being game to rewrite something, even if maybe as a writer, you don't initially agree that the rewrite's going to be good. Like maybe in your head, you're like, I don't think this is going to work. But no, you have to try it, right? Because it means something to that actor. And so you try it and you go home that night and you rewrite the monologue in a way and you bring it in. And almost always, the actor's right. Like almost always, maybe a few days later, I'm like, oh, I see why that's important. And I'm glad we made that change. And so there's just a way of working that maybe is not conducive to every writer. You know, if you're the type of writer who's like, no, this is the way I wrote it. You know, the pause is there. Honor the pause. That's not this type of playwriting. This type of playwriting is a kind of a sort of radical space of working together, collaboration. And, you know, but at the end of the day, the playwright's the one who has to go home and put the lines on the Paige and bring in the new Paige, you know, the right? Like, that's not the actor's, it's the playwright's job to recreate the monologue. And you do that through a process of listening and collaboration. A lot of my plays in the last 5 years have been co-written. And I'll be honest with you, I mean, if I was doing Kite Runner today, I would co-write that, right? Like, I wrote this script in 2006, and the ideas of appropriation and who can tell a story were present in 2006, but perhaps not as much as they are today. And if I was doing Kite Runner today, there's no doubt in my mind it would be a co-written project, the way many of my recent plays have been. I mean, there's so many people who have had input on this script over the years. Homaira Gilzai. Homaira is our cultural consultant, but that title does not really do her role justice. I don't have the vocabulary for what she does on this show, and she's worked on many productions since 2008. Khaled introduced me to her in 2008, and she came to San Francisco as an Afghan refugee. She's an American citizen now and has a family in San Francisco, but she's been working on this show, and to your previous question about getting things accurate from a cultural point of view, Homaira's done a lot of that work. You know, she'll come in and work with the actors on Dari language, accents. There's a wedding in Kite Runner, which is culturally really delicate because, you know, real wedding takes several hours, but we do it in like 90 seconds, right? So we're already changing it. And then the question is, well, what elements are you going to put in and how are you going to do them right? And so Homaira basically directs the wedding. And there are other things in the show too, a birthday party, a prayer. There's a prayer toward the end of the show. And you just want to make sure you get all those things, at least so they're not offensive. So the people who identify with the space don't see the show and go, oh my God, they have no idea, right? You want them to at least look at it and go, oh, well, they have tried, you know, they've tried to understand. And I'll tell you what, the show that's on tour right now, that cast got like the best compliment ever, I think I've ever heard on Kite Runner. Homaira, in other aspects of her life, has worked to settle recent Afghan refugees in the Bay Area. Settling them is perhaps not the best word, but she's worked to, you know, help them make this place a home. And so she brought four of these folks who came over here recently after the fall of the government, or after the United States, you know, left Afghanistan and the Taliban came back in. And so these four people have come here, and she brought them to the show last week in San Jose, where we launched the tour. And one of them said to me, she said the Dari language that the actors are speaking was so good that I thought they were Afghan Americans, the actors. They're not Afghan Americans, the cast, right? They're a bunch of things. Like, that's just the best compliment ever. And that's the sort of work that Homaira does, is she works with the cast to get things like Dari language appropriate and accurate. So we spend a lot of time on that with this show.
What were some of the other challenges, you know, to bringing this to the stage? Because it's a tough story, right? It's really a hard story to hear about and read about from an emotional perspective as well. I read the book a long time ago, but I still think of it now and then because it just was so intense. Like, how did you translate to that to the stage? If I know it's so much more than that.
There's a lot. There's so much in Kite Runner, right? Like, it's an intense story. It's emotionally intense. There's a lot of different themes, right? It's a story about two best friends. It's a father and son story. It's a story about immigration. It's a love story. It's a story about global politics. And there's all of this in the piece, in the book, and in the play. You know, I don't know. I mean, when you're writing something, you're just sort of following your intuition and trying to do the best you can. I mean, I suppose there was a part of me that worried, is there too much? Like, is it too much just a matter of storytelling and themes? Is it too big? Like, that works in a 350-page novel, but in a 2-hour stage play, like, that's a lot of stuff. But what I will say now, 20 years on and watching the play, I don't know, hundreds of times, it's like every scene advances the story. Like, there's never a scene that's like, oh, that scene seems a little indulgent. It doesn't really advance the story. It's just people talking, you know, like every scene pushes the story forward. And so you have to listen. And if you fall into the magic of the piece, it's just this like roller coaster of a story over 2 hours.
Now, the actors who are in the show, they play multiple roles, right?
There's 12 actors. And as you note, they all played multiple characters, except one. The main actor plays one character himself. actor, and that's it. But the other 11 actors play a bunch of characters. I think there's probably 41 or 42 characters in the play that are split up among the 11. And it's an ensemble piece. And so the ensemble is constantly coming in and out of the stage space in different characters with different costumes, and they're doing different things. And yeah, of course, in Act One, there are, what, five kids that are age 12 in Act One, but they're played by, I don't know how old the actors are, but the actors are not age 12. And so they play these children in Act One, but then they also play a ton of other characters throughout the play.
What about the music? There's music in it too. It's not a musical per se, but there is music in it, right?
There is music. And I mean, I think the artistry of the music in this particular production is really, really something special. There are a lot of different components. Jonathan Gerling, who has composed the music for the piece, has worked with Salar Nadir, who plays tabla. Salar is on stage playing tabla live. And the two of them have worked together to create the music for the piece. And there's a bunch of different things. There's the tabla, obviously, but then there's also actors singing off stage. And Jonathan has written that music for the actors who sing. You don't see these actors, and they're so good that you would just think, oh, they're playing a music track. But it's not a music track. It's live singing that the cast do off stage in various parts. And that's really beautiful. There's singing bowls that the cast occasionally use on stage. There's a special instrument called a Schwierbergen that like makes a wind noise. And those come in and out. And then there are various kinds of drones and other kinds of cues. I think the sound and music of the show is truly, truly special. What Jonathan and Salar have created is amazing.
Like the kite action, like how did that requires some mechanics, right? Well, in an ordinary world, it would require wind and a sky and all that stuff. But how do you translate that to the stage?
Well, yeah, I mean, for people who don't know, right, there's an Afghan, well, it's not just Afghan, but it's in other countries too. But there's a tradition of kite fighting, where you take a piece of string and you mix it with ground glass and glue. So you make your string really sharp. And then when you fly your kite next to somebody else's, if you hit their string in just the right way, you cut their kite. And they lose, right? And it's a tournament, and you can have hundreds of kites in the sky, and the last kite flying is the winner. And so that's a whole thing in the book and in the movie. The movie does something really beautiful with that. Yeah, so how do you do that as a stage play? Different productions have done different things. Sometimes it's just a kite string that the actors are using. I saw one production in Boston that did literally use big kites that flew over the audience's head. I don't mind to say it because I think it's one of the best scenes in the show. But this production, I'll say what they do, they mime it. It's done through mime, which is amazing because they've had to choreograph the mime. We have a movement coordinator, Kitty Winter is her name, and getting the ensemble. So there's like these 12 actors on stage reliving this kite tournament with such precision and such choreography that you, the audience, imagine it. Right. That's what we're trying to achieve with the shows, with that scene, is by miming it with such precision and the choreography of the piece, it comes alive in your head.
The Kite Runner will be on the Proctor's main stage May 1st and 2nd. That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more from inside the newsroom. In the meantime, check out timesunion.com or any of our social channels for all the latest news and features. The Eagle is a production of the Times Union. It's produced and edited by myself, Jessica Marshall, with help from the Times Union digital team and the newsroom. Special thanks this week to Dan Clark for his contribution to this episode. Support for this podcast comes from CDTA. The Eagle, a Times Union podcast driven by CDTA.